Hey, thanks for downloading the very latest podcast from PeterBCollins.com. In a moment, another Boiling Frogs podcast, co-hosted with Sibel Edmonds. And we've got the latest analysis from globetrotting journalist Pepe Escobar on the U.S. rush to an assault on Syria. It's quite an eye-opener, so stay tuned. I want you to hear it. I like to begin by thanking the people who support this podcast with their subscriptions. Charles Lowy recently tried the $24-hour pass to test drive podcasts here at PBC.com. Also, monthly subscribers Teresa Paris and Tadish Durbin, as well as Joao Filho. I thank you for your support, one and all. And I invite the rest of you to join the cadre and help support this independent effort at bringing you news and commentary. Just follow the links under my picture on the homepage at PeterBCollins.com. You can sign up easily in just a couple of minutes. And if you're a new annual subscriber, $50 a year, I will bonus you Sibel Edmonds' important book, Classified Woman, and a bag of Kona coffee beans supplied by Russ Archibald and his team of coffee growers on the Big Island of Hawaii. And the other way you can support us is by steering your web business to GoDaddy.com. I've been doing business with them for over 10 years, and they've got great customer service and incredible deals. Like right now, starting at just $1.99 a month, you can get web hosting and with unlimited storage and bandwidth, and they'll give you a domain name free. Follow the links in the show file for this podcast at PeterBCollins.com for additional special deals from GoDaddy.com. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. We're joined once again today by one of our favorite international journalists, the globe-trotting Pepe Escobar, who writes for Asia Times online at atimes.com. Pepe, as always, we're delighted to talk with you.
Oh, come on. It's always my pleasure.
Well, Pepe, we are speaking with you on September 3rd, and we want to make note of the date because the way people use podcasts, they don't all listen immediately after it's released. And today we're going to discuss a highly fluid situation, the U.S. intent to launch a unilateral strike on Syria. And over the Labor Day weekend, there was a dramatic shift as the president stopped saber-rattling for a moment. He did say that he is intent on making this strike on Syria, but he has decided to seek approval from Congress. This came after the British Parliament narrowly rejected a resolution to join the United States. France has been equivocating, but the latest from President Hollande is that they are eager to join the fray. Beyond that, the United Nations is unwilling to sanction this because, of course, Russia and China hold vetoes at the Security Council. NATO has said no thank you. And so the president is increasingly isolated in a box of his own creation because, as it's important to note, it was his rather offhand remark that he didn't want to get involved in Syria, but if they use chemical weapons, that would be a red line that would change things. And so I want to begin by asking you about the events of August 21st. And there's a great deal of speculation in the international media that this was not a chemical weapons use by the Syrian military, by the government of Bashar al-Assad. And that gets good play in the Russian media. Russia, of course, did the investigation and determined that the so-called rebels did use chemical weapons in March of 2013. And so it's not an idle question about who actually might have been responsible for this alleged assault. So let me begin with a kind of compound question about the so-called evidence that has been presented by Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama. And it flies in the face of on-the-ground reporting from Mint Press that says that in the town of Ghouta, there are people who say there is a chemical weapons cave where they have been storing materiel. They also say it was supplied by Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia. I haven't been able to confirm that report, but I find that fascinating. So if you could take a moment to talk about the alleged events of August the 21st and your sense of whether we know who actually may have caused it.
Well, even before the Deyo Gavlak report, which is absolutely astonishing fact. In fact, when I read the report the first time and I saw the name Prince Bandar bin Sultan, I fell off my chair, literally. Number one, because I was already writing about the role of Bandar Bush in this whole story, which it's very important. We always have to come back to that famous 4.5-hour meeting between Bandar Bush and Putin in Moscow. The story in itself is extraordinary because it was leaked by a Russian diplomat. It ended up at As Safir newspaper in Lebanon with an Arabic translation. Then it was translated into English and then started to circulate it with among a few journalists, myself included. And it's pretty much most of it verbatim, in fact, what the main themes they had discussed. Some things stand out. The fact that brazenly Bandar said that they control all the Chechens in the jihad, not only the Chechens in the Caucasus, but the Chechens fighting in the jihad in Syria. And the Chechens that used to be in Iraq, of course, now they're across the desert. He more or less threatened Putin that if he didn't accept the House of Saudi, which is drop Assad and we buy a lot of weapons from you and we're going to protect your commercial pipeline relations with Europe. This is ridiculous, in fact, because the Russians are not threatened at all. In fact, Gazprom, they control 25% to 30% of the gas supplies to Western Europe. And he said at the end, look, so considering that we don't have a deal regarding Syria, there's only one possibility left, a military solution. So he more or less telegraphed to Putin what was going to happen next. And what happened next includes something that is very, very important. In July, in Iraq, the Minister of Defense, they busted a cell, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in fact, connected to Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria. They were fabricating rudimentary chemical weapons. And under interrogation, you can imagine what sort of hardcore interrogation it was. They said that these chemicals would be transferred to Syria to Jabhat al-Nusra. And this is probably what happened only a few days later, in fact, or probably happened before the chemicals were, some chemicals were already in Syria. Even before the Deyo Gavlak report, I wrote a story more or less trying to outline the best possibility, considering all the information that we had, that contradicted the narrative coming from Washington. And putting together a lot of different sparse information and counting with some very remarkable people, including a Finnish researcher. His name is Petri Kron. He, in fact, he opened a wiki page just to follow the details of everything that might or might not have happened in Ghouta. So putting together all this information, the most likely scenario was These are chemicals, rudimentary chemicals, or kitchen sarin, as it's called. They were transferred from Al-Qaeda in Iraq to Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, which is basically a bus or a car across the desert, you know, very simple. Kron has established that the rockets came from an area called Kaboom in northeast of Damascus, in a suburb totally controlled by the rebels. And the place where these rockets came from was theoretically a Syrian army base, but it was taken over by the rebels in June. So the rockets came from over there. It, in fact, conflates with Gavlak's story as well, because in this area, over 90% of the people, they are anti-Assad. But some, in fact, most of them, they are not Jabhat al-Nusra or Salafi jihadis, hardcore jihadis, Wahhabis, with a connection with the ultra-hardcore Wahhabism. So imagine a commando coming from Syria, from Iraq, sorry, to Syria. They set up their base in this area, inside a military base that is controlled by the friends of the Free Syrian Army. They launch this false flag. They have no emotional or direct connection with Syrian civilians, especially because they are not Syrians, these people. You find among them, including Chechens. The Chechens Bandar was referring to Bush. Mm-hmm. These are basically jihadi mercenaries, or, you know, people from the global jihad that have been going to Syria, and some back and forth between Syria and Iraq for over a year now. They retreat, and this explains why locals told Deo Gavlak that, yes, these people are here, they were mixing. We didn't know what they were doing, but probably they were mixing chemicals. And we're not aware of it. And some of the relatives of these people living in Ghouta, they even died in the attack. Mm-hmm. So all this together, it's a much more plausible explanation than the official American explanation, which, as we also know, for days now, was passed to them by the Israelis. Via Amman, Israeli military intelligence, and especially by Benny Gantz, who apparently forwarded information directly to General Martin Dempsey, Joint Chiefs of Staff. This is the only so-called evidence that Washington has.
Well, and Pepe, what we've been seeing is incredible use of innuendo and the presentation of circumstantial evidence. And they, for example, it's often stated by those who support a military strike on Syria that they have chemical weapons. That has been known for a long time, but that doesn't mean that they used them. And the level of proof that is being offered, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, says, we know. He said we know something like 20 times in his prepared remarks on Friday. And one of the things he said we know is that we know where they were launched from and, you know, where they landed, and that is proof positive of who was actually responsible. But one of the key pieces that I've heard that I wanted to get your thoughts on is that these grisly videos were actually uploaded to YouTube hours before the reported event occurred. Have you been able to confirm that that line of story?
Not for all of them. Mm-hmm. Some of them, yes. But there are more than 40 videos, apparently, that are being quoted, not only by the Americans, by the French report that came out this Tuesday morning, which is an 8-page French report. It mirrors the American report as well. And intel is YouTube intel. The French don't even get the so-called Israeli evidence, which is based in that 8200 unit of the IDF, which is specialized in electronic intel. These are the guys who told the Americans, look, we listened to one commander talking to another about a chemical attack. Also circumstantial as well, and no definitive proof. The very UK ambassador Craig Murray, he also wrote an excellent post completely debunking the Israeli intercepted intel scam, because he said, well, if Israel had intercepted that, the UK, they have an even more sophisticated interception, and they didn't get anything. So, you know, basically, most of it is YouTube intel. And also very important, a few days after the August 21 attack, I was trying to remember the exact date, August 24, Syrian army commandos, they were raiding a maze of rebel tunnels in another neighborhood near Damascus, Jobar. And guess what they found in these tunnels? Kitchen sarin as well. Maybe it was part of the batch that came from Iraq. Maybe it was another one that was there for even longer. And obviously the soldiers, they were attacked by some kind of nerve agent, as they said. So the Syrians sent samples to Russia for analysis in Russia. We don't know if they had already performed all the analysis. If they did, I'm sure this is part of President Putin's rebuttal that came over the weekend as well, saying that the evidence that the Americans have is completely unconvincing. Of course, because the Russians, they also have samples from another area, and they could see what kind of nerve agent it was. Mm-hmm. Probably kitchen sarin.
Pepe, one of the other issues is that the reports from Western governments they vary wildly in their estimates of the number of people killed. I believe the French are in the 200 range, and John Kerry has set the bar very high. He claims over 1,300 people have been killed. And so even on the fundamental and kind of basic who, what, how many issues, we don't have clear evidence. We have propaganda.
Exactly. And look, like Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, I know some of these people, including Bernard Kouchner's partner, in fact. I used to talk to these people in Paris years ago. It's complicated because they are very, very close with State Department, Israeli intelligence, French, DGSE intelligence as well. There is a hidden agenda, and they may have been, or they are actually being manipulated this time as well. The only thing that they said for sure is that they counted themselves 355 victims. So how can Kerry talk about 1,400, you know? Even MSF, they only certified 355. And they said, yes, it looks to us they were a victim of sarin. They didn't specify what kind of sarin. It could be kitchen sarin as well. Very, very, very tricky. You know. So, and the Russians, I think, considering that they have samples taken from one of the sites themselves, analyzed in Russia, the Russians could come forward and say, look, we have evidence. This is what it was. This is the nerve agent. It is sarin, it's not sarin, even if they cannot prove where it came from. And even if the UN, it's going to take another few weeks for a decent appraisal of the samples they collected. Nah? But they don't have a mandate to say where it came from still. The best previous example that we have of very thorough professional investigation is what the Russians did after an attack in March this year. It took them 3 months to go there, interview a lot of people, collect samples, go back to Russia, write an 80-page report, which was presented by Ambassador Vitaly Churkin at the UN last month, and they said conclusively, look, we are 99% sure this came from rebels in a rebel position. But it, you know, it took them 3 months to do that. That's in an 80-page report. How can you expect the UN inspectors to fulfill their job in a week or 2 weeks? It's absurd. And in fact, Kerry was practically extending the inspectors this past weekend. And they were, in fact, expelled. They worked for 3 or 4 days, which is completely absurd. What one interesting thing is, apparently they talked to some of these Syrian commandos who found this nerve gas in these tunnels near Jobar. That's, let's see what they're going to say about that, right?
Well, Pepe, I want to go back and talk about Russia and the Russians. It seems like lately I always want to talk about Russia and the Russians here, because I still believe this is going to be the most important factor on what's about to come with Syria. And let's start with the meeting between Bandar and the Russians. We had a recent trip there to Russia. What was that meeting all about, Pepe? What do you think?
It was absolutely extraordinary, because you remember that Bandar was the victim of an assassination attempt in July 2012.
Right.
There was a lot of speculation a year ago that he was killed. At the time, the best information that we had, from a diplomat, in fact, that the usual anonymous diplomat, he didn't want to get into trouble. He confirmed that there was an attack. Bandar was hurt, and he was being treated at an American hospital. He wouldn't say where. Could be an American hospital in Dubai or in the mainland U.S. This was the best that we could do after, you know, weeks trying to find out something about it. That's completely from view for a year. And reappeared spectacularly. First photo of Bandar in over a year is that photo of Bandar shaking hands with Putin in Moscow. So that's up to everybody, you know, who's been following Bandar, of course, and everybody in the Middle East as well. This, you wouldn't find that photo everywhere in the Arab media. Only if, you know, some newspapers publish it, in fact. Well, after that leak, the leak came a few days later, first at As-Safir in Arabic, then translated into English. And then, and it's fascinating, because basically Bandar starts like a very good salesman trying to sell a super plan to Putin. Look, we have our divergences, but we can agree on Egypt, because we both want the Muslim Brotherhood to disappear. Okay, so they agree on Egypt. They agree on the coup, essentially, which was more or less from the beginning promoted and instigated and supported by the House of Saud. But Syria is another story. The idea was if you, the Russians, drop support from Syria and leave the UN Security Council to pass a resolution, which is, in fact, will authorize a no-fly zone and, in fact, a bombing of Syria. What are we watching now, in fact, by passing the UN? We start build by buying $15 billion in weapons from you. There will be more on the way. We won't interfere with Gazprom selling more oil and gas to Europe, blah, blah, blah. And more or less, we can organize the new OPEC. The new OPEC is going to be us, Saudi Arabia, and new Gazprom. Putin said, no, I'm not interested. I'm not buying it. So, like I said before, Bandar Bush said, we control all the Chechens, so there's going to be trouble for you in the Social Olympics in 2014. So this is a serious threat that you know the Russian intelligence has to take it seriously. And especially the threat regarding Syria. Now there's no other solution except from a military solution in Syria. This is what Bandar said, because there's a stalemate in the Geneva II process, and Geneva II is not going to happen. He said that brazenly. It's not going to happen. And the Russians know why Geneva II is not going to happen, because the Americans have been blocking from the start. Apparently, Kerry and Lavrov have been talking about Geneva II for months. They organized it. But postponed since June. It has been postponed for 3 months already. Probably it's not going to happen because the opposition, from the beginning, we already know. What passes for Syrian opposition is that myriad of groups, all sorts of opportunists, exile, non-exile, non-defectors, ultra-Wahhabis, by the way, and very, very few Christians, if any. Sunnis, hardcore Sunnis, and hardcore Wahhabis. They don't want to talk. They want, in fact, the agenda is the Obama administration agenda is Assad must go, period. Nothing, and there's nothing to discuss. We discuss later. Which is completely absurd that the Russians already knew that. And they have been complaining and pointing their fingers at Washington for months now, saying, look, they are derailing a possible peace process. In fact, before Bandar Bush more or less forced the Americans to get rid of Qatar, because this is what happened. The Qataris wanted the Muslim Brotherhood in power in Syria, basically. They were more or less running the war in Syria, and the Saudis were taking a back seat. Once King Abdullah appointed Bandar Bush as the director of national intelligence, Bandar came like the Terminator, really. He convinced the Americans to drop Qatar and said, I am going to run this thing now. And we're talking about Bandar Bush, the guy who ran 90% of the Afghan jihad in the 1980s. So this is the real dark arts practitioner. In fact, it's the conclusion phase, in fact. The moment Bandar Bush took over running the Syrian war in the name of the House of Saud and in close connection with Washington, it's no holds barred. He's going to use every trick in the book. And that's why I, in this bag of tricks, I can clearly see a false flag operation using chemical weapons as the only pretext that they have to have bombing, a bombing of Syria. It's the perfect, there's no other better pretext now and in the near future. And if it doesn't work now, it's going to be very hard later on to invoke another chemical weapons attack and constitute a false flag out of it. So it has to be now. It's the famous window of opportunity. And Bandar decided to go for it from the start. He was appointed by King Abdullah. He convinced the Americans. They dropped Qatar. He, you know, intensified the support for Salafi, jihadis, Wahhabis, hardcore Sunnis, whatever you want to call them. At the same time, the training of the first 300 by the CIA in Jordan near the Syrian border was already finished. So they are training another batch as well. So why not try to put it all together? False flag plus these people are going towards Damascus. And then we can have a mix of commandos on the ground, the boots on the ground that Obama said they are not there. They are there already. They are JSOC and CIA. These are the shady boots on the ground. They're already there. We won't have the Marines, but who cares? You know, we have commandos already on the ground. And obviously, if the false flag works, a bombing, which is not going to be a slap on the wrist like Obama said, or a shot across the bow, or any other stupid Orwellian euphemism. It's going to be, the way I see it, a sustained bombardment with Tomahawk cruise missiles, stealth bombers, you name it. And I'm sure you have seen the draft resolution circulating in Washington. It's more or less calling for an open-ended war. It's very, very scary.
Pepe, here is the billion-dollar question. See, I'm not saying a million-dollar question. I'm saying a billion-bucks question. How far Russia is willing to go with this?
Oh, this is the, I would say it's the trillion-dollar question. No, I would say it's the amount of U.S. dollars held by the Bank of China, in fact.
There you go. And your answer?
Look, we don't have a crystal ball because we are dealing with a master chess player. His not making his move. He is just, it's fascinating the way, I would say, the way Russia, Iran, and China are playing at the moment. It's fascinating. They are not making any moves. They are silently watching like ninjas in the dark, you know. Because there could be a lot of different developments. Suppose the U.S. gets bogged down in another war in the Middle East. It's good for the three of them just to watch it, you know, the quagmire develop. They still don't know for sure the range of this bombing. They are not taking Obama at his word that this is going to be a surgical, limited, kinetic, whatever, you know. I'm sure they are assuming this thing is going to last for a while. But the thing is, how far is it going to degrade the Bashar al-Assad government? And is it going to provoke a coup inside Damascus? Will these commandos trained by the CIA will be able to infiltrate serious positions inside or nearby Damascus? Or nothing's going to happen. Assad is going to be there in the next 6 months, 8 months, 1 year from now, he'll still be there. And then nothing will fundamentally change. In fact, very interesting. I was talking to a very good Saudi friend. He's not a source. He's a friend. But I consider him the enlightened future of Saudi Arabia if one day they get rid of the House of Saud. And he was telling me, look, if in 6 months nothing happens, and the situation is the same, I'll bet with you that the House of Saud and Bashar, they will cut a deal under the table, which is very, very Arab way of doing things, right? So we cannot rule that out either. So at the moment, Iran, China, and especially Russia, man, with our master chess player, just waiting. Which I think is a fantastic Sun Tzu strategy, in fact, you know. They are expecting the aggressor, which in this case is going to be the U.S., assuming the bombing starts next week, and it could, to be entangled in its own net, just like the president of the United States got entangled in its own net of proclaiming a red line without recklessly, without thinking about the consequences.
Well, Pepe, considering all this drafts and what has been happening in the past week, my feeling is U.S. never wanting to have or to get involved in any kind of direct confrontation with Russia, that some deals have been cooking up in the background. Now, let's put ourselves in Russia's position. What would it take for Russia? What would they want in return to say, okay, fine, go ahead? So if there is a deal cooking up behind the scenes, or it has already cooked and is all ready to be served, what would Russia want from the United States in return for saying, fine, is going to be hands off from us on Syria? People talk tough, and they have been talking very tough, but when the push comes to shove, we are going to just let you carry it out. What would they do it for, Russians? Your guess. I know it's subjective, but what do you say? What would Russia want?
Sybil, the Russians more or less, via Putin, via people in the foreign ministry, via Lavrov himself, they already said, not in stark terms, that Syria is a red line for them, in fact. For Hezbollah is a red line, for Iran is a red line, you already know, but also for Russia is a red line. They have a weapons client, a commercial partner, and obviously that naval base in Tartus that they can use for docking rights every year. It's not that they occupy the base all year long, but they can have docking rights over there. So it's Russian presence in the Eastern Mediterranean. They know that if there's no more Assad government and there is an ultra-hardcore Sunni government, Emirate style like the Saudis want, or Muslim Brotherhood like the Qataris want, this thing will be gone completely. And they know what NATO wants. NATO wants to rule the Mediterranean as a NATO lake. That was part of the rationale to attack Libya, because Libya was not into it. There is part of the rationale to have ships in the Eastern Mediterranean very close to Lebanon, because part of Lebanon, the Hezbollah, is not into it. And obviously, Syria is not into it. Once they control Syria and Lebanon, it's going to be a NATO lake forever. In fact, the Mare Nostrum of the 21st century. So the Russians are very much aware. It is their red line. They don't have to say it out loud, but it's quite clear. And there's nothing the U.S. or NATO can offer to them for them to drop a client and a partner just like that. Nothing. What? More investment in the Russian economy? They don't need that. They have a strategic partnership with Germany, in fact. They sell all the oil and gas that Germany needs, and they have German investment in the Russian economy. It is a strategic partnership, and the Germans are very much happy with it because they need the energy, most of all. So it's not Russia is begging for foreign investment or for foreign help. They don't need it.
Mm-hmm. Pepe,
partnership with China on top of it. So,
Pardon me. Pepe, I wanted to ask you to give us your view from outside the United States, because we are getting waves of propaganda from the media in this country, and they're satisfied with the idea that Obama has knuckled under to allow a vote of the Congress, even though he telegraphs at the same time that if the vote doesn't go his way, he reserves the right to act unilaterally anyhow. And I wonder if you could give us your observations about just how reckless this prospective strike is, because I don't see any coherent strategy when you say, well, we want to give him a shot across the bow, but we don't really want to change the chemistry of this civil war, which means that we really want the stalemate to continue. And despite the crocodile tears over deaths via chemical weapons, the United States is very comfortable with large-scale casualties continuing on a daily basis as long as they're not caused by chemical weapons.
Exactly. You can kill as many Arabs as you want, or you can kill yourself, you crazy Arabs. We don't care. But if you use chemical weapons, that's a red line, and we're going to bomb you. This is what passes for military strategy or for political strategy in Washington these days. I had another very interesting conversation a few days ago with two American friend sources, let's put it this way, some of the best minds in the U.S., the East Coast, and they were both appalled at the level of was really, really hardcore the way they define it, but basically a bunch of clowns. This is how they define the people surrounding Obama. From Susan Rice to Samantha Power to that ridiculous David Rode, which passes for, he was a hack for the Atlantic, if I'm not mistaken, now passes for a super advisor to Obama. They only left behind Brzezinski. Which is not,
Dr. Kissinger was unavailable.
But Brzezinski is not a day-to-day advisor to Obama. Brzezinski, more or less, I think he gave Obama a crash course on international politics in 2008, and that was about it. Huh? Maybe Obama picks up the phone and calls Zbigniew once in a while, but I'm sure Zbigniew is also appalled because when you look at the non-political and military strategy of the Obama administration, it defies belief, to tell you the truth. First of all, this story of going to Congress, it was a Hail Mary pass. He knew that he was boxed in by his own established red line, and he couldn't get away with it by himself. So I say, look, so let's split the cost here. If Congress votes for war, which he's counting it's going to happen, because, of course, they have counted the votes before and they think they have the votes. They do in the Senate, but not exactly in Congress. But when they look at Congress, what do they see? They see a Congress that is controlled essentially by AIPAC. we could say that, what, 60% of Congress at least is controlled by APEC.
It's so higher.
Theoretically, they have the votes in Congress as well, mm-hmm. right? The House of Saud lobby in D.C., especially because of Bandar Bush, is incredibly powerful, almost as powerful as Israel. So obviously they are also working with Congress. So when we have APEC plus the House of Saud, plus a lot of, I would say, maybe most sectors of the industrial military complex working on Congress to launch a war, it's practically a done deal, right? So it was a clever Hail Mary pass. But obviously, nobody knows what could happen next. If this is a limit kinetic whatever, it's going to be totally stupid because everything will remain the same. The stalemate will remain. There won't be regime change. This could go on for years, in fact, which in a sense also suits the U.S. because it's a replay of the Iran-Iraq war for 8 years, a stalemate with horrendous casualties on both sides. This is exactly what could happen in Syria. On the other hand, if we have what neocons and House of Saud especially really want, which is a really hardcore bombing in terms of leading towards regime change, it could be even worse because then there's going to have retaliation, not only from the Russians, but from the Syrians, mm-hmm. but from Hezbollah,
yeah.
potentially from Iran. And who knows if Russians are killed in Syrian soil, even from Russia as well. And then we enter Pandora's box multiplied by 1 million. So I can't believe that this... you know, Susan Rice, a national security advisor who doesn't advise her president of all the risks inbuilt in a shallow humanitarian imperialism adventure. What kind of a cabinet is this? You know, it's it is really, like my friends describe it, a bunch of clowns, but very dangerous clowns.
Well, and Pepe, at various times, the president has articulated all of the arguments against the moves that he is now in motion to take. And, you know, we're seeing on television here almost every video package about the whole question of Syria includes at least one clip from somebody in a refugee camp in Jordan or in Syria who says, you know, I can't believe you won't take action. And they're the equivalents of the Iraqi National Congress. And while I understand that people who are in a refugee camp want to see things change, they certainly don't want to be there, they're not the people that Americans need to take this advice from about the right move to make. And I argue that if the U.S. wants to make a dramatic statement and demand that no further civilian life be lost to chemical weapons, we should drop a million gas masks and NBC suits. And that's not the television network. It's nuclear, biological, chemical. And we should airlift those, or maybe for some stimulus effect in the United States, we should FedEx them and distribute those to people in Syria. That would send a much stronger message about the U.S. red line than following mindless violence with more mindless violence.
You're absolutely right, Peter, but it's the reflect, I would say it's the inbuilt reflex of the superpower, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, still thinks in Cold War terms. Obama tried to define Putin as thinking in Cold War terms. Forget it. It's most of the industrial military complex that's still thinking in Cold War terms. And now somebody who has no strategic idea of a reckless action in the middle of a Middle East. He's the first to say, we are retreating from Iraq. No, you are retreating from Iraq. You're crossing the desert and you're going to be on the other side of the desert, in fact. And you're not going to bomb and get away. If there is a response, and this response could come from any corners, it will involve American casualties as well. And what are you going to do next? Redouble your bombing effort, your kinetic whatever? You know, it's completely crazy. That you'd at least, It's crazy when you think about it, because before, in other adventures, you could detect some brains behind it. For instance, in the Afghan jihad, Brzezinski more or less was, okay, let's organize this way. They wanted a long-term jihad against the Soviet Union at the time as a means of exhausting their resources. They were more or less successful for a number of reasons. And obviously, for the key reason is that after a few years, when Gorbachev came to power, he looked at that thing. No, this is absurd. What are we doing there? Let's leave. So it was a unilateral decision by Gorbachev, in fact, because of, no, there's nothing we can gain from it. It's not because of the it was not a direct result of the American strategy, in fact. Or, as the Mujahideen used to say, we expel the Soviets. No, maybe you accelerated their retreat. But in the end, the Soviets decided to retreat. In Assad over there, he's not going to retreat anywhere. They have nowhere to go. It's the government. They have already proposed. In fact, crazy, until 2 years ago, they were still our bastards. You remember that. Mm-hmm. There were some neoliberal reforms. Assad was opening the economy a little bit.
Right.
Kerry was having dinner with Assad and his wife at the Damascus restaurant. Mm-hmm. He was not Hitler. He was one of our bastards, you know. But, you know, the whole thing started to evolve because of the Arab Spring, and especially because of the Saudi way of influencing Washington policy. Everybody in Washington bought blindly the myth of a Sunni-Shiite divide and the Shiite arc that is threatening Sunni established governments all over the Middle East, which is completely absurd. In fact, it's the other way around. It's the other way around. It's especially hardcore Wahhabis, financed especially by Saudis, by Kuwaitis, by Emiratis, who are threatening the whole of the Middle East with the possibilities of new emirates or caliphates all over the place. And that includes those crazy Chechens in the Caucasus as well. But everybody in war, it's crazy. They always pick the wrong fight. In Afghanistan, they picked a fight against Pashtuns, which is the worst thing you can do in your life. And they picked a fight with Pashtuns from both sides of the border. It's the largest tribe in the world. There are 40 million Pashtuns between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The United States of America picked a fight with 40 million people. You simply cannot go. It simply cannot work. And now they're picking a fight with Shiites all over. If you are Shiite, you are controlled by Iran. So we are against you. This is the official Washington policy, dictated by Saudi Arabia. Come on, it's really a bunch of clowns, huh, when you think about it.
They sound like. Pepe, I have two related questions. They're actually part of the same question. One is, for a while, almost every day, I was reading all these different headlines and reports on the Kurds in Syria and their positions, and they were issuing statements. That front has been pretty quiet in the past, I would say, a week to 10 days, and that kind of coincides with everything that is going on here, with beating the drums louder and louder. So what is happening with the Kurds? Because the last I heard and the last I read, they kind of distanced themselves from the rebels, the jihadis. And why we have had this quiet silence period in the past week or so from the Kurdish front there in Syria?
Oh, yes. In fact, the Syrian Kurds had been fighting the jihadis in some areas that are more or less contiguous between, you know, villages that are being nowadays, for all practical purposes, administered by Syrian Kurds, and and some jihadis who had bases in the middle of the desert near those mountains where it's most of the Syrian Kurd population. I had something great for you, Sybil. What the leader of the Kurdish Democratic Union Party, the PYD, Saleh Muslim, that's his name. You know what he said only a few days ago? In fact, it was an interview with Reuters, if I'm not mistaken. He said, point blank, that the chemical attacks were aimed at framing Assad. Look, these guys are not supporting Assad, and they are not supporting the rebels. There was a deal between Damascus and the Syrian Kurds that if you don't attack us, we won't attack you. You can do anything you want in northeast Syria. That's where Syria Kurdistan is, more or less. So this the leader of the top Kurdish Syrian Kurdish party saying that this thing was basically to frame Assad. That he's more or less absolutely sure that the rebels did it because the Bashar al-Assad government have no motive to launch a chemical attack when the UN inspectors were arriving. And this is something fantastic. If the UN people discovered that this was not by the Bashar al-Assad government, are they going to punish the Emir of Qatar, the King of Saudi Arabia, or Mr. Erdogan of Turkey? So this gives you an idea of what the Syrian Kurds, how the Syrian Kurds are observing the whole thing. In fact, from the stands, because they had skirmishes with jihadists, but they are consolidating their administration in the Syrian Kurdish area. They are attacked with the Iraqi Kurds, and when Mr. Erdogan looks at it, he freaks out even more because what he sees is a practically independent Syria Kurdistan, very close to the line with a practically independent Iraqi Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. So this is where we are at the moment.
Pepe,
the second part of my question,
go ahead.
And again, this is related, has to do with, and this again from some of the alternative media's headlines, and that is they keep talking about the divide between the rebels, the terrorists, the jihadists. But it's not clear from these articles where the dividing lines are. So what factions are we talking about in terms of this latest divisiveness on U.S. attack? Because they're saying, this is the headline, and I'm reading it, saying the rebels are divided on the imminent U.S. attack.
Well, the short answer to this, Sybil, is all myriad of Free Syrian Army gangs, some of them branches of Muslim Brotherhood, some of them aligned loosely with Muslim Brotherhood, some of them basically defectors from the army, not many. These are in favor of bombing because this is what they have been asking for over two years now. And this includes especially all those gangs who were being financed, protected, and supported by the Qataris. They still are, but now the Qataris are much more in the back. On the other hand, the Jabhat al-Nusra style, Al-Qaeda style, Salafi jihadis or ultra-hardcore jihadis, they are afraid that they are going to be attacked as well. That the regime is going to be bombed, and their positions, assuming U.S. intelligence knows where they are exactly, which is not a given, they're going to be attacked as well. So they are saying no, and if we are attacked, we're going to retaliate. So a set retaliation front as well, which would be these absolutely demented jihadists attacking American interests all over the Middle, not only in Syria, but in Iraq, in Jordan, certainly, or even in Lebanon as well. They already promised that they're going to retaliate if they are bombed.
Well, Pepe, that's a very important point, and it's what I wanted to ask you about next, which is the contrast of American arrogance, that we can launch this limited, targeted strike that will spank Bashar al-Assad without really changing the balance of terror in Syria right now. Yet we seem to assume that there would be no repercussions. And to me, that's what makes this move so reckless, that it really is just a shot across the bow or a statement. But it comes with incredible risks, including widening the Syrian conflict into a regional or even a world war, and also unintended consequences on the part of a response from Hezbollah, further problems in Egypt. The list is pretty lengthy.
Tell me about it, Peter. I think without crystal ball, the only thing we know is that if this bombing lasts a little over 2 or 3 days, if they instead of launching 5 or 10 cruise missiles, they launch like they did in the first day in Libya. At the time, I think it was 157 or 159. If they do the same thing in Syria, there is going to be a response. Don't forget that they have anti-ship missiles, the best in the world. They have the Russian Sunburn, which could sink that mini armada that U.S. has in, 5 ships so far, maybe 6. They could be sunk in 10 minutes. So what is the U.S. going to do after that? Bomb Syria to the Stone Age, like they did to Iraq? Is going to be a new shock and awe then? Are they going to organize a shock and awe in 3 or 4 days? Okay, it's already. They could do it. But they are saying they are not doing it to start with. And Hezbollah as well. If Israel is side by side with the U.S., and Israel tries something funny against Hezbollah, the response, same thing. They have over 6,000 missiles, Hezbollah, and they know how to use them. Not to mention Iran, which in terms of asymmetrical warfare, I would say they have a PhD on the matter. 8 years of practice against infinitely superior Iraqi forces in the 80s. And these guys are now, all of these guys are now top commanders of the IRGC. And we're not even talking about what Russia is going to do if Russians are killed in Syrian soil. And there are a lot of advisors. There are a lot of engineers. So, yes, what you said is absolutely – it could even develop into the embryo of a World War III. That's how reckless and how immensely, immensely dangerous this whole thing is. But we still don't have anybody in Washington talking sense. Once again.
Yeah.
Crazy. We have Susan Rice as the new Paul Wolfowitz. Maybe she's expecting the U.S. to become the new OPEC again. You know, maybe she read her script wrong.
Well, and John Kerry gave us a Colin Powell performance.
Yes, exactly. The only thing missing was the vial.
Right. Or a map or a PowerPoint drawing of Curveball's mobile weapons lab. Pepe, I wanted to close by asking you to comment on kind of a follow-up piece. When we last year discussed the events of Benghazi, the curious way that the Obama administration responded while being attacked by Republicans at the height of the presidential campaign, and you said that your sources were indicating that CIA operation in Benghazi was grabbing weapons from the Gaddafi stockpile and spiriting them out to Syria. And we've actually seen some confirmation of that in recent weeks. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to confirm what you had offered as an opinion or a prospect many months ago.
Yes, absolutely. And there are a lot of Libyans fighting in Syria as well. So this is the and the weapons they came with the fights with the jihadis themselves. In fact, it was a double shipping of weapons and jihadis, mm-hmm. Affiliated most of them with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who by the way is still the military commander of Tripoli, by the way a failed state run by militias, courtesy of NATO. And now many of these Libyan Islamic Fighting Group fighters, they were exported to Syria. And they have their own militias as well, very intimately linked with Qatar. Because don't forget that many of them were trained or retrained by Qatari special forces. So, yes, makes total sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pepe, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining us today, and we may have to convene again very soon. These these are important times, and things are moving very quickly, and we always appreciate your perspective.
Thank you, Peter. Always a pleasure talking to you and Sybil, and I wish you would be in a more fortunate circumstances. Probably next week is going to be even scarier than today, unfortunately.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.